Brigadier General Benton Kirk Parton. He died at age 94 at the end of December, but today is his military funeral in Arlington National Cemetery. General Ben Parton is a great man, a great scientist, a great person in terms of his impact on weapons development and strategic thinking in the 20th century. And so this is a journalism story about someone who people should know about. And he is a member of the Board of Frontline Fellowship. Brigadier General Benton Kirk Parton, U.S. Air Force. General Ben Parton is one of the most influential innovators in developing focused energy and precision-guided weapons. General Parton was a close friend of missionary to communist world, Reverend Bill Bathman, a member of the Board of Frontline Fellowship, and a very good friend of our family and our mission. General Parton was born in Lumberton, North Carolina. He entered active military service in the Aviation Cadet Program January 1944. After World War II, he didn't take an active part, he was just training during it. He returned to North Carolina State College, where he earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Chemical Engineering, graduating June 1949. As a reserve officer, Training Corps Distinguished Military Graduate, he is commissioned as a second lieutenant in the United States Air Force in 1949. August 1949, he is assigned to Strategic Air Command, SAC, as Assistant Operations Officer. 91st Reconnaissance Technical Squadron at Barksdale Air Force Base, Louisiana. In March 1950, he entered the pilot training at Randolph Air Force Base in Texas, and would have flown planes like these. And he completed his advanced flying training at Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma by March 1951. During the Korean War, after C-54 training at Great Falls Air Force Base, Montana, he was assigned to an air transport company squadron in the military air transport service at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii. He flew in support of the Korean airlift and conducted nuclear weapons tests. He also served as assistant aircraft maintenance officer, and I think few people understand how, especially in Air Force, how many people it takes behind the scenes for every pilot actually operational. In September 1953, General Parton entered the Air Force Institute of Technology as the first graduate Air Ordnance Program, where he earned his Master of Science degree in Aeronautical Engineering by 1955. In September 1955, he's assigned to Ballistics Research Laboratories, Aberdeen Proving Grounds, Maryland. And there, as an inter-service exchange project engineer, he worked on a variety of armaments projects, developing warheads and fuses for both the Air Force and Army missiles, and bombs like these. July 1957, General Parton was assigned to Air Weapons Directorate Headquarters, Air Research Development Command, Baltimore, Maryland, and tested every kind of explosive imaginable on trying to destroy every imaginable kind of target. He later moved with the command headquarters to Andrews Air Force Base, Maryland. There he was assistant for advanced weapons concepts, and during this assignment he served as technical secretary to the Weapons Committee. He joined the Committee on Limited Warfare in 1958. And there he pioneered a coherent optical frequency generator, which generated the acronym LASER, Light Amplification Stimulation Emission Radiation. I don't know how many people you know what LASER stands for. From 1959, General Parton served as Systems Analyst in Research and Engineering, Headquarters Air Force Systems Command, Andrews Air Force Base. Later, he is Research and Development Analyst at the Air Force Systems Command. 1961 to 1964, General Parton studied operations research at the Case Institute of Technology and Statistics at Western Reserve University, Cleveland, Ohio. He is assigned March 1960 to Deputy Chief of Staff Research and Development Headquarters, U.S. Air Force, and there his duty was to be Development Engineer in the Directorate of Development. He participated in the establishment of the Armament Systems Division and formulation of Accelerated Ordnance Program, and served as Tactical Systems Development Plans Officer in the Directorate of Development Plans. All this is going somewhere, and I'll show you it's got important implications on the main body of what we're saying, but he's a scientist, an engineer, and a weapons specialist. So he would have been dealing with every kind of weapon system and everything through to the uranium and plutonium bombs and warheads for the Trident ballistic missiles and every level of the development of these weapons, and from medium through to intercontinental ballistic missiles. And so these were the finished products of the kinds of weapon systems he was working on. In June 1967, General Pardon completed his studies at the Air War College as a distinguished graduate. He then received C-123 combat crew training and was assigned November 1967 as a special assistant to the Directorate Tactical Air Control Center Headquarters, 7th Air Force, Tan Son Nhut Airfield, Republic of Vietnam. Probably the most important air base they had in South Vietnam during the war there. And this would have been your base operations area. And they came under attack and it was operational. March 68, he's appointed Director Tactical Analysis at the Air Force Headquarters, 7th Air Force. Then in January 1969, General Pardon was assigned special duty in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, OSD, as the first Chairman of Development of Defense Air Ammunition Requirements and Development Committee. This is the first time there was such a committee, and he was the first chairman coordinating for all branches of the U.S. military. With organizational changes in the Office of Secretary of Defense in 1970, additional responsibilities were assigned to him as Assistant for Aircraft and Air Ordnance, ordnance meaning explosives, weapons, in the Office of the Assistant Director of Land Warfare. June 1970, General Pardon was transferred to Elgin Air Force Base in Florida, where he served as Commander of the Air Force Armaments Laboratory and would have dealt with all these kind of aircraft all on the runway at that airbase. June 1972, he was assigned Deputy Director Development and Acquisition, Deputy Chief of Staff Research and Development at the Pentagon, the headquarters for the U.S. Air Force in Washington, D.C. On the 1st of September 1972, General Pardon was promoted to Brigadier General. He was a command pilot. He wore the Missileman badge. He is appointed Deputy for Aeronautical Systems Division at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio. His military decorations and awards include the Distinguished Service Medal, the Legion of Merit with two oak leaf clusters, and the Air Force Commendations Medal. As a military command pilot and command missileman, he flew 4,000 hours, including 37 hours combat. General Pardon's education qualifications include a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering, a Master of Science in Aeronautical Engineering, and he completed the classwork and assignments for a PhD in Operations Research and Statistics. Although for some reason he didn't finish the final to get the award, but he did all the work that a PhD is required to do in science. All in all, General Pardon served in the U.S. Air Force for 31 years of active duty. He was a pioneer of precision-guided weapons on a scientific, technical, executive level. He directed the organizations engaged in the research, the development, the testing, the analysis, the requirements generation, and the acquisition management of precision-guided weapon systems. So from A to Z, he is covering the details of precision-guided weapons. And his assignments varied from the laboratory to the Office of the Secretary of Defense. It was his initiative that was picked up by President Ronald Reagan and named Space-Based Defense Systems, or SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. And the whole, this whole concept was General Pardon's concept of being able to intercept ballistic missiles, create a safe shield, and have space-based defense systems where you could intercept using space-based interceptors, not just radar, but laser, to destroy missiles in their booster phase, being able to distinguish between the correct vehicles and the decoys and the re-entry. And of course, you want to get them early. Late is too dangerous because those warheads are going to come down somewhere if you don't get them, and so on. So he had multiple systems in order to counter the ballistic missiles, obviously especially thinking the threat from the Soviet Union and from Red China. And so there's a whole range of integrated from Army, Navy, Air Force, how to respond to the threats, how to even use ground-based laser using mirrors from satellites to get down to actual origin where they are coming from, maybe halfway around the world. And so space-based defense became Strategic Defense Initiative, which the press called Star Wars, SDI. Among General Partner's contributions in the field of research and development included cluster bombs, for which he developed button batteries. He designed Puff the Magic Dragon, the side-firing Gatling gun system, which could fire 6,000 rounds a minute. If you've seen the Green Beret film of John Wayne in Vietnam, they finally clear the field with the Puff the Magic Dragon coming in, and they do a circle and basically destroy everything in about a one-mile square area through this Gatling gun system. I mean, that's multiple Gatling guns firing out the side. He designed the cruise missiles and GPS, global positioning systems, to deliver precision-guided missiles to exact addresses. He had already designed these in the 60s. Now, we only got civilian application of them somewhere in the 90s, I think, that GPS has started to become known in civilian circles. But the whole purpose for GPS is to deliver cruise missiles to the exact address needed. They can go down the road, turn at the corner, go down the stairs, knock on a door, and deliver their warhead exactly where needed. The development of laser-focused energy weapons, also his innovations. And so in 1989, the White House appointed General Parton Special Assistant to the Federal Aviation Administration to prepare the White Paper on Federal Aviation Administration Policy on the Use of Global Positioning Systems, GPSs, an operational life for commercial aircraft, anti-terrorism protocols, airport and airway capacity requirements in the FAA acquisition process, and also federal aviation leadership and management development. Some of his publications include Global Terrorism Analysis on the Sino-Soviet Conflict, which he says is the chief disinformation weapon of the Soviet Union Red China, that there was a split between China and Russia so serious that America alternately was selling weapons to, or giving weapons rather, to Red China to build them up against Russia as the main threat, and then giving weapons to the Soviet Union to build them up against a threat against China, and building weapons to, because they believed that there was a genuine threat where Red China might ally itself with America against the Soviet Union, or Soviet Union might ally itself with America against Red China. And using this disinformation campaign of the Sino-Soviet hoax, they were able to justify vast amounts of American weaponry and food and other supplies to alternately build up their two greatest enemies overseas. So he said, and he proved, that Sino-Soviet split was a complete and utter hoax and disinformation campaign. He's written Deadly Failures Intelligence Analysis and Defense Unpreparedness, the Oklahoma Bombing Mura Federal Building, and the TWA 800 Shootdown. So he's a whistleblower too. General Parton surrenders life to Christ as a youth, maintained a strong faith throughout his life. He's a generous, thoughtful, hardworking Christian who cared very deeply about his country and about the church worldwide. He loved his family. He's survived by his four children, Kirk, Wayne, Bruce, and Bonnie. He has his grown-up children. This was just about 4 years ago when he turned 90. He is blessed with 13 grandchildren and 18 great-grandchildren. Quite a family. And just, I think this was last year's Thanksgiving when he would have been 94. The first home I stayed in the United States was General Parton's home in Captain's Row on the Potomac River, close to Mount Vernon, the farm of George Washington. This is Mount Vernon, which was not far away. Nobody organized more meetings for me or drove me to more events or hosted me longer in the home than General Parton, without any close second. From the first time I landed in the United States, January 1988, General Parton was my most enthusiastic supporter and guide as to how to best communicate to Americans the threat posed to Christians in Africa by communism and radical Islam. General Parton introduced me to senators, congressmen, military leaders, radio and TV presenters, key media people, church leaders. On many occasions, the general drove me hundreds of miles across Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, throughout Washington, D.C., for businessmen's luncheons, prayer breakfasts, political meetings, military meetings, radio, conferences, TV broadcasts. and to give testimony to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, the Defense Intelligence Agency, to Senator Jesse Helms' office. And Senator Jesse Helms was the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for many years. Senator Jesse Helms read my Mozambique report into the congressional record and defunded Mozambique, bringing a skiddy halt to their persecution of the church to regain American support. So Jesse Helms was a very powerful friend of ours at that time. This brother is Senator Jesse Helms' office. I was introduced also to Admiral Jeremiah Denton, who's a senator at the time. He had been tortured in Vietnam. In fact, I read Senator Denton's book When Hell Was in Session, just before my first imprisonment experience, and that prepared me very effectively. I was also introduced by the general to Captain Red McDaniels, naval aviator, Captain Eugene McDaniels, tall red-haired man who was tortured for 6 years in the Vietnamese concentration camp that they called Hanoi Hilton, and Jeremiah Denton for 7.5 years. Here's Captain Red McDaniels at one of the public meetings. Dedicated Christians, good friends of the general. During the many months that we worked together on different projects, we spent many hundreds of hours discussing geopolitical issues, history, military technology, contemporary issues, and most importantly, biblical practical solutions to reclaim our countries for Christ. The general financially sponsored a number of projects, including getting our Holocaust Rwanda books posted to every congressman and senator in the U.S. Capitol. General Parton loved taking me out in his motorboat on the Potomac River, where we could see eagles and other bird life, and the imposing Mount Vernon, home of America's first president, George Washington. And so we'd be roaring around his motorboat out here, often evening cruise as the sun was setting, and before maybe an evening meeting. I enjoyed staying at the Parton home for many reasons, and one was the beautiful George Washington Memorial Parkway forest path that I often ran along in the early mornings. Beautiful, lovely, running in the shade the whole time. So one funny incident which showed the differences in our cultures and our communication style was February 1988, my first visit in America. I heard the general calling out loudly, "Peter, come here! There's a snake in laundry. Get rid of it." So I dashed down to the basement, which, while lower than the street level, was on the level of the garden, which led directly to the Potomac River. I opened the door to the laundry, collected a broom and a rake, and proceeded to coax this 4-foot-long snake. Not this one. I didn't have a chance to take a picture of the actual one. It was just a representative snake. Out from behind the washing machine, into the garden, and then wrapping the snake around the rake, carried him off the property, deposited the snake into the bushes some distance away. And as I returned, the general was standing there in obvious shock at the doorway, saying, "You let it go! You told me to get rid of it, sir." And he said, "I meant kill it." And as a conservation-minded South African, it never crossed my mind to kill the snake. I said, "It wasn't poisonous, sir." "Well, how do you know that?" he asked. I said, "Well, it didn't have any exotic markings on it. It probably was just a mole snake of no threat to humans." And the general related the story so many times to friends and at meetings as part of the introduction for me speaking at something. Often a story came up. Here he told this African to get rid of a snake and I'd just release in the wild without killing it. And he just couldn't believe why you'd do that. And I couldn't understand why he'd want me to. The general related to me how distressed he was in studying the strategic bombing of cities during World War II and the enormous loss of civilian life. Now, he came into the Air Force in 1944, so this was going on at the time, and that's what he was studying. Strategic bombing command. Saturation bombing. Strategic bombing. 63 cities in Germany were destroyed, he said. Over 2 million people, almost all civilians, killed by the Royal Air Force and United States Army Air Force strategic bombing offensive. Just during World War II. 2 million civilians, 63 cities. As a Christian, he said, I knew that such an enormous loss of civilian life was unacceptable. Unacceptable. You cannot target civilians. That's not Christian. It's not right. I prayed for the Lord to guide me, he said, as to how we could bring about precision bombing to take out, for example, a bridge without destroying the entire town around the bridge. He said frequently they'd destroy the entire town and the bridge would still be standing. The bombing of cities was not only unethical, he said, but counterproductive, wasting vast amounts of ordnance, hundreds of thousands of tons of ordnance on civilian targets. It lengthened the war rather than shortening it. And so he told me that while studying the strategic saturation bombing campaigns of World War II, it led him as a Christian to pioneer and promote precision-guided weapons as his life's calling to save civilian lives in future conflicts. And this verse inspired him. Deuteronomy 20, verse 19. When you besiege a city for a long time while making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy its trees. Concern for the environment is part of God's law. How much more concern for the people and the animals in it too. So the general then related to me how tons of advanced research, shiploads of research, came out of the German Army Research Center at Peenemünde Test. The Germans had, of course, pioneered the first operational fighter jets, Messerschmitt 262, the first pilotless bombs, flying bombs, the V1, and these were incredible that they could get them up and get them stabilized and getting to a target. And of course, these were not guided missiles yet, but they were the first long-range rockets. And then the V2s, which was phenomenal, because this is a serious rocket. And this, of course, to stabilize it so it doesn't go spinning out of control, they had to invent the gyroscope, and they had all sorts of incredible, you know, from the warhead, the automatic control gyros, the guiding beam, the radio control gear, the antenna, the air rudder, the gas rudder, the alcohol valve, combustion chamber, all of these different things from the liquid oxygen tank. Very, very advanced technology. This, they were, as he said, decades ahead of the rest of us in their ballistic training, in their rocket development, their jet development. And one bomb in particular really excited the general's interest. The first recorded operational use in the history of precision-guided munitions was a guided gliding bomb, the top-secret German guided gliding bomb named Fritz X. Now, when the Italians changed sides and their navy went over to the Allies, the Germans used their Fritz X against the Italian battleship Roma, which would have been a phenomenal force, the biggest battleship in the Mediterranean. And so they destroyed the Roma with just two bombs. This huge explosion and black billowing smoke column gave evidence of the incredible success of this ultra top secret guided gliding bomb named Fritz X. Here's the Roma sinking 9th of September 1943, the Fritz bomb. Launched on 9th of September 1943 by a single Luftwaffe Dornier 217 medium bomber aircraft, it took only two such bombs to sink the pride of the Italian Navy, their battleship Roma. And several United States ships were sunk shortly afterwards, victims of this new ship killer, the Fritz X. And so here are some artist's impressions of the first precision-guided weapons, the Fritz X, being deployed first of all by the Dornier, and then the U.S. cruiser USS Savannah hit by a radio-controlled Fritz bomb just a few days later, the 11th of September 1943. So this is the first precision-guided munition, the Fritz X. And this you can see in the U.S. Air and Space Museum in the Smithsonian Institute in America, and absolutely incredible. The spoilers, the elevation functions, the fin spoilers, the rolling gyro housing, and how they managed to stabilize this guided, radio-guided bomb to its target. And the intention was to have this was never used operationally, but they had a 400 jet aircraft, it was the Heinkel Ardo, I think, and if they had come along, this jet aircraft delivering precision-guided weapons, imagine what they could have done if it had been developed in time and if they hadn't run out of fuel and everything else. So in the Smithsonian Institute, you can actually see the Fritz bomb with the Dornier aircraft that actually delivered it. And this was already showing the general the way to go. Well, Professor Werner von Braun and hundreds of the scientists came over and defected to the West and brought their years of research, tons of patents over to the USA. And as he said, decades ahead of the rest of the world, missile and rocket development and precision-guided technology. Peenemünde. They devised a Y-guided bomb in which they managed to destroy a Soviet warship, and on this basis, General Patton became a pioneer of precision-guided weapons in the U.S. Air Force and started to design weapons like these. In fact, the Germans had already started tests on launching rockets and missiles from submarines during the war, and they had plans to send one to send a rocket into New York as a vengeance against the bombing of their cities by the U.S. Air Force. Again, that didn't take place in time, but they had the technology already, out of which the Polaris missiles were developed. So some of these weapons he tested during the Vietnam War. For example, he took out a strategic bridge with a single bomb without any collateral damage amongst civilians living on both sides of the river, exactly what his vision had been about 20 years before. Well, that's his military background. So now we come to him as a whistleblower. I remember this so clearly, 19th April 1995, when the Alfred Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City collapsed, killing 168 people, including children. General Patton immediately declared, "Somebody is lying." And I was quite interested because I hadn't seen the general so animated so quickly. And this was the worst domestic terrorism ever experienced in America to that date. And these are some of the scenes of people coming out of this building. I mean, this is sheer terrorism, a bomb taking place in a building which was meant to be the FBI and ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms headquarters. And although there was no ATF and FBI agents in the building at the time of the bomb blast, and it was on the anniversary of their destroying the Branch Davidians compound in Waco, Texas, which I think had happened 2 years before. So this is David Koresh and so on. This is during Bill Clinton's administration. And you can imagine the firefighters and first responders, the horrific scenes that they witnessed, and to drag out the bodies out of this unbelievably shocking situation. And firefighter Chris Fields cradling Bailey Allman in his arms. This image came to symbolize the tragedy, more than a tragedy, an atrocity. And just notice this picture. You meant to have had the crater, the truck bomb, parked on the street, but notice pieces of this building are on the roof of on the other side of the street. How does a bomb here blow material from there all the way over to the street onto the roofs of other buildings? The damage done by what's meant to be a fertilizer bomb truck, which is 1/8 the capacity of normal TNT of the same weight. And TNT is pretty basic compared to, for example, plastic explosives or something more military grade. But the amount of children killed was the greatest shock to everyone. It was, as I said, a blow to the heart. Here's just some of the pictures of people who died in that terrorist bomb attack. As I said, the worst act of domestic terrorism in the United States history. Well, the devastation went far and wide. Federal agents surveying the scene. As one of America's foremost weapons experts, General Patton could immediately see the damage pattern on the building was not consistent with a truck bomb on the road, but could only have been the result of a building demolition team embedding explosives in the actual reinforced concrete pillars holding up the building. General Patton declared the pattern and magnitude of the damage in Oklahoma bombing was technically impossible without supplementing demolition charges on the columns and header beam. You can go onto our website and see the links where he's speaking, and there's different interviews that he did with media. And he has asked on a number of occasions that I was there as well, where people asked him, what do you suppose, how would you speculate, what do you think, assume? And he said, I'm not assuming anything. Let me tell you what actually happened. And he'd give the scientific explanation. He says, you know, I don't need to guess. I don't need to give my opinions. I can tell you with absolute certainty what happened. There were demolition charges placed on B3, A3, A5, and A7 columns. There were four demolition charges because those reinforced concrete steel beams have disintegrated. that cannot happen from a bomb of any magnitude parked in a road. You've got other of these pillars closer to the supposed truck bomb, which weren't even affected, not even scratched, not even the surface area of it affected. And you've got others further away that are disintegrated. This was done by a demolition team. Clear signs of contact charge, smooth failure points, exposed steel rebar. And so here he's calculates the pressure. You know, you've got 500,000 pounds per square inch at the point of explosion, but it's down to something like 20 pounds per square inch by the time you're getting to some of these pillars. He said, and that's bicycle tire pressure, bicycle pump pressure. You know, that can't take down a reinforced concrete pillar. He said, the blast force falls off very dramatically. Air is very inefficient means of conveying any kind of shock. The positioning of the collapsed columns and the header beams showed it could not have been caused by a truck bomb. Otherwise, they would have been blown at least slightly inwards. Instead, they came straight down. The general declared it was absurd to hold that a truck bomb blast was powerful enough to take down large reinforced concrete columns and leave sheetrock, planters, furring strips and other light decorative materials virtually undamaged. The structural damage was consistent with a professional demolition team who had embedded explosives in the heavily reinforced concrete beams and columns. By 13 July 1995, General Parton released his 23-page report, which was mailed to the FBI and to 78 congressmen. Bomb damage analysis of Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, Oklahoma City. And he argued that a single bomb explanation cannot account for the failures of columns B3, B4, B5. And he points out that the asymmetrical nature of the damage to the Murrah Building is one indication that demolition charges were used in the bombing. He said, unless you believe in magic, you've got to accept this was not done by a truck bomb. The study includes 5 full-page color photographs taken of key areas of the crime scene, which the general personally investigated, and he said this provides irrefutable evidence that at least 4 demolition charges were set off at 4 critical columns of reinforced concrete structure at the floor level. You can see bare rods. Decorative ring with bare rods, header with bare rods, and juncture covered. Demolition of columns A3, A5, and B3 shown here. The report also included an important aerial view diagram of the Murrah Building showing the position of the truck bomb in relation to the building damage and by computation of the general of the potential damage of the blast wave pressure in concentric circles as it radiated out from the blast force. This is a matter of scientific calculation. And notice, architectural decorative grooves unaffected. Fracture there, contact explosive damage, you can't get exposed rebar any other way, and so on. And he diagrammed the effects of the bombing showing light building materials basically untouched, yet heavily reinforced columns disintegrated far from where the truck bomb was. Now, you can't have the blast reaching clear into column B3 and bring down that heavily reinforced column at the same time, not even blowing off light covering from this column. You can see sheetrock surface unaffected. Just not possible. How do you blow everything out, then take out reinforced concrete while you've got decorative materials closer to the bomb blast not affected? And here again, at column 5, you can see complete demolition of this column. The general made clear in official reports given to congressmen and to the FBI and on TV shows and public meetings the official story that the horrendous damage done to the building had been caused solely by a truck bomb did not add up. It violated the laws of physics. Building after the cleanup. The reported facts contradicted not only the laws of physics, he said, but a lifetime of personal experience as a weapons ordnance developer. There could be few engineers in the world with more impeccable credentials in the fields of explosives than General Ben Parton. And so he was featured in the New American Magazine on a number of occasions as a key authority for the case for a cover-up. And there's powerful evidence that the federal agents were not surprised by the Oklahoma blast. Interesting, you've got on 9th floor the DEA and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms and the Secret Service and all of that, and none of them were in work on that weekday at 9 a.m. in the morning. None. Interesting, just some of the movements of the people who are accused of this. We'll get to that later. But you can see what different agencies were at the different places. But the shocking thing is, on the second floor was a baby daycare center. None of the children of any of the FBI-related state officials were in daycare that day. Very, very, very strange. Notice heavily damaged all around the area. How is that possible that the blast could go that far and affect all of those areas and yet be one truck bomb? And yet they had people who spoke about bombs and heard multiple bombs going off and all the reports, but there's testimonies of the multiple bombs, multiple people and so on. And in the end, it came down to one lone person, Timothy McVeigh. Just like the multiple shootings of U.S. President John F. Kennedy was done by one person with a bolt-action rifle. And he was shot so fast in such short order from so many different crossfire directions. And in the end, there's no conspiracy, just one man, and he got killed conveniently. All kinds of mysteries of the Oakland bombing began to unravel soon. Now, here you can see the header columns, and there's plain explosives were used. Building cross-section and definite cover-up. Did federal agents have prior knowledge? If the bombing of the Mura federal building was a terrorist act, why were no ATF or FBI agents injured or present? Why was every badge-carrying federal agent absent from work at 9 o'clock on that weekday morning? The Oklahoma City Fire Department said they were warned by the FBI before the bombing, given advance alert of a possible terrorist attack that day. And 2 years later, Timothy McVeigh is executed for it. And Timothy McVeigh never said a word in his defense. Now, he was a special forces soldier who never had a demerit, never did anything wrong, was the perfect soldier, always obeyed orders. And he at no time tried to defend himself, no time tried to justify or anything else like that. He just was obeying orders. In fact, his sister said when he left special forces, he said he's still with them, he's working on a secret assignment. And even on his death certificate, where he is, if he was actually executed, as they said he was, it's got his occupation, U.S. soldier with his force number and all of that. So it looks like he was still on the books of the U.S. Army when he was even executed. That's if the execution is real. There were other people who were called as suspects and assistants, collaborators in this, who somehow escaped prosecution. This is one of the John Doe number 2 McVeigh accomplice that the police were looking for at the time, and the routes they took, where McVeigh was seen working with other people with the Ryder truck that had the truck bomb where it was hired. It's quite clear in the end that he was working for the state. In fact, he went up to Elohim City in Idaho, where there's some white separatist supremacist group, which actually turned out to be entirely made up of federal agents. They came from every different agency, didn't know that they were spying on one another. There was not one legitimate member of this group. It was started by different groups with the National Intelligence Agency or the FBI or CIA. And the whole lot was just one big sting operation, right down to Timothy McVeigh. They were all working for the government. And it looks like he was set up as a patsy. This Hussein, who was observed being part of this, filed a lawsuit for being accused of being part of it. And here's one of the testifiers who said that an ATF agent lied about using the elevator when the elevator couldn't have been used, and different inconsistencies in the stories. Science and common sense point to demolition charges. You just need to think of how they imploded the entire building afterwards. So the general was asked, who do you think did this? And he said it couldn't have been done by Timothy McVeigh and this truck bomb. He said, and who do you think can say it? He said, well, I'm member of the US Air Force, retired, still under military law. I can't tell you who did it, but I can tell you who's covering up the evidence. The US government under Bill Clinton destroyed the evidence. Even though senators and congressmen were pleading, don't destroy the evidence, the investigation is still ongoing, they imploded the building, buried the evidence. They literally dug a massive hole, trucked everything in, buried all the evidence of a crime scene. By the way, blowing up the entire Mura building took less than 150 pounds of explosive. That's about 70 kilograms of explosive to bring down the whole building, because it doesn't take much explosives if it's embedded or in contact with the concrete pillars. You need a lot in a truck bomb, and that won't do as much damage. So 70 kilograms took down the whole building in a controlled demolition. But they were trying to blame everything on a 4,000-pound fertilizer bomb truck parked in the street. Well, there was more and more questions asked afterwards. And, of course, the memorial services, people were arrested, like this Nichols, but he wasn't actually at the crime scene, but somehow avoided getting any kind of conviction. This is the last survivor who was pulled out of the wreckage of the building 12 hours later. And yet witnesses said they saw Timothy McVeigh with different people immediately before this. And plainly, he was working as part of a team. And yet, the official version is one man was responsible. No conspiracy, no collusion, lone, just like the lone gunman with the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, the lone bombman. This is now the site of the Mura building, which is now Memorial Park. I've written about this in the False Flags and Subversion campaigns. That's just one example of a false flag operation. The best film on this is A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, 1995. This is about a two-hour documentary, absolutely conclusive. Look at every side of the cover-ups and the lies and the amount of first responder eyewitnesses who got murdered afterwards, and the one local TV station which was exposing what is going on in the reports and the multiple bombs and multiple people and so on. The next thing, they get bought out by a New York-based conglomerate. Everyone's fired, the whole investigative journalism buried, and on it goes, the cover-up. This was a false flag done by Bill Clinton's government to cover up the crime of what they'd done at Waco, Texas, because all the files on the Waco, Texas Branch Davidian David Koresh massacre done by the ATF was in this building and all conveniently got blown up at the very time the Senate was demanding investigation into the Waco massacre. And then that gets blown up, and the ATF takes the date of the time that they massacred all these women and children at Waco, Texas, and suddenly that date is now transferred to them because now they were the victims. All and none of them were present. But the building was blown up with all of their files and documentation, which the Senate can't subpoena anymore. It's a filthy, dirty, disgusting, noble lie. And there's just no question. And Brigadier General Ben Parton appears conclusively in here from an engineering explosives testimony point. But there's a lot of other sides to this unbelievable, dirty, false flag operation. Well, General Parton had field tested all kinds of explosives on a broad spectrum of structures and targets. He is the earliest advocate for focused energy weapon program, the first chairman of the Office of Secretary of Defense Joint Services Air Munitions Requirements Development Committee, responsible for Air Force, Army, Navy, and Marines. He also is the whistleblower on the TWA 800 shootdown. Now, you may recall there was this horrible accident which made no sense. And the general looked at this, and when they recovered the pieces of the aircraft, said, "This is a continuous rod missile hit." And to demonstrate it, he got one of these aircraft that you buy in the shop, and he showed he designed the continuous rod missile system to get rid of, for example, kamikaze pilots and so on. There were cases in the Second World War where a Japanese kamikaze pilot's plane was coming in, and it had been shot to pieces. The pilot was dead. The plane was stricken. And the plane kept continuing and crashed straight into the ship, still exploding, causing damage. So he designed a continuous rod missile. that would go up and cut the aircraft in half so that aerodynamically it would immediately fall flat and to see it couldn't continue to glide on to its target. So a continuous rod missile was specifically designed to explode in such a way as to cut in half an aircraft. And the damage pattern on TWA 800 was of a continuous rod missile. And there was even pilots, experienced pilots with military background, who said they saw a missile coming up from the ocean. In other words, like from a submarine, and shoot, take out this whole aircraft. And why is a good question. That's a whole different story. But this is what the general just demonstrated as what happened then. He's got the test measures, and it's on our General Parton website. General Parton was a brave and tireless crusader for truth. In fact, he took me to the CIA headquarters and showed me where they've got in concrete at the entrance of the CIA, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free," John 8:32. I don't know if the CIA would recognize the truth if they tripped over it. I mean, they walk past it every day, and if only they operated on knowing the truth as revealed in the scripture and embodied in Jesus Christ. General Parton worked hard to provide me with platforms to speak up for the persecuted church, Mozambique, Angola, Zimbabwe, Sudan, Rwanda. He also provided practical insights which assisted the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, the SPLA, in their fight for freedom against Islamic Jihad in Sudan. He knew the capabilities of the Sudan Air Force and of their weapons potential and of the best countermeasures for this. And they were communicated. We praise God for this innovative scientific genius. Here he is, just 4 years ago, at his 90th birthday, pictured with his daughter, his only daughter, Bonnie. General Parton loved his country, the Lord, his family, the church worldwide. He is a true friend and a great example. General Parton can declare, "I fought the good fight, I finished the race, I've kept the faith." You can visit www.generalparton.com website, which we maintain here, to view some of General Parton's global terrorism analysis articles and videos. We're uploading some of the videos where he's given lectures so that people can benefit from the insights of this technician. And on our frontlinemissionsa.org website, we've got an article in tribute to him and on our in memoriam page as well. So are there any questions, any comments on General Parton and his background?
Yes. Attacking their compound.
ATF attacking David Koresh's compound.
From the compound to the police to say, "Hey, these guys are attacking us. Like, yes. We've got children inside here."
And the police sheriff wanted to come out and help, but they were prevented by the FBI.
So what they said, it was McFay in a revenge attack for that.
Yes, that was the cover.
Yeah.
But Timothy McVeigh he wasn't a lawless person. He was a youngster who always obeyed orders. It's hard to believe that he just discharged himself from special forces and went on his own and gave himself the assignment, and no one gave him orders. And he, you know, he wasn't an initiator. He was somebody who followed orders. And people who leave special forces, as they say, there's no such thing as ex-special forces. They really, when they leave the program, it's often because they're put on an assignment. It's a black op.
He was asked for the death penalty. He said, "I'm the master of my own fate." And then he asked for the death penalty, and then the judge said, "Okay, I'll give it to you."
I didn't pay that much attention. Really? Wow.
Yeah, he actually said, "I'm the master of my own fate." And that proves it. He said to the judge, "No, you must leave me dead."
You know, I don't know if they faked his death like Jeffrey Epstein's so-called suicide, which is a lot of evidence it wasn't, and he walked out the back door and changed his identity, or if they actually killed their own man, or whether he is silent all the way along because they told him, "Don't worry, just keep quiet, we'll look after you, we'll slip you out," and then they still killed him. I don't know what happened, but what I am convinced about is that scientifically his truck bomb that he's accused of couldn't possibly have done the damage that was done. He couldn't have operated alone, and so he wasn't, if he was responsible at all, he did it under orders from from the military that sent him out there.
So what is the story behind the bombing then? What is the true story? Why was a building bombed?
Well, now we're on to conjecture. The scientific evidence that General Parton could give was that the official story didn't add up scientifically. It's not possible. And that there had to have been contact bombs on those four columns to have caused the damage. So, obviously, a man parked in the street couldn't have done that. But he said when he went there, what shocked him was all of those columns are behind the security of the building, which is a federal building. And so whoever planted those bombs had to have had security clearance, which Timothy McVeigh did not have for that federal building. He wasn't part of any of those agencies. So when he was asked, who do you think did the bombing? He said, I cannot tell you who did the bombing, but I can tell you who is covering up the evidence. The US government, from Clinton through Janet Reno, was ordering a complete cover-up. And just imagine the worst crime scene in America's history to that date. And they implode the evidence and take it and bury it and get rid of, literally bury it, literally got rid of all the evidence. And then they continue with this single person responsible, which doesn't make sense. Okay, so what could their motives have been? What could they have stood to gain? Now we're just guessing. But educated guesses that I've heard are that they took the anniversary of the Branch Davidian massacre, which was caused by the ATF and the FBI, 2 years later, and they now turned on to we the victims. They got rid of all the evidence that was being subpoenaed by the Senate for an investigation to the ATF's behavior at the Branch Davidian compound, Waco, Texas. In addition, within the first 24 hours of the bombing, what was Bill Clinton blaming? He was blaming Focus on the Family, James Dobson, homeschoolers, and pro-lifers for this bombing. I mean, pro-lifers, for goodness sakes, and homeschoolers. And that was the official thing. And now, although not a gun had been used, this is a bomb, for goodness sake, and a rental truck, he introduces new legislation to crack down on private ownership of firearms. And a whole lot went through. Many things went through. Legislation, it was steamrolled too, because people think we've got to do something. And so they pushed through a whole lot of legislation that took away a lot of freedoms and gave a lot more power to the government as a result of this bombing. So who benefited? Bill Clinton's government, New World Order. And they used it to slander people who, of course, had nothing whatsoever to do with this. I mean, imagine blaming James Dobson's Focus on the Family radio program for this. Because he says they're creating a distrust of the federal government. Well, why would you distrust the federal government?
Because Tim McVeigh was arrested by policemen driving that pulled him over for a broken tail light or something on the
yes.
The hired van.
Exactly. Exactly. He's a special forces soldier, and he doesn't think about a broken tail light on a rental van.
I just have 2 comments. I mean, Tim, if you knew that he's going to be executed, why not blowing yourself up with the building? I mean, and the other thing, the vehicle was, the bomb inside the vehicle might just not detonated to set off the other bombs, because you don't need a big, it's plastic explosive, you don't need a big charge to set them off.
Yes, but, you see, if a whole lot of detonations took place within the building, you'd just say, oh, a demolition team's done this, and how'd they gain security access? So the truck bomb was a cover, just a smoke screen.
Yeah.
Distractor.
With no federal agents in the building at the time or their families. So
that's awfully suspicious.
That's a real stupid cover out there.
It's not very impressive. Yes.
What precisely happened at Waco, Texas?
Okay, Waco, Texas. The ATF, that's Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which is a branch of the FBI under Janet Reno, who was at that stage Attorney General, under Bill Clinton, of course, went to Waco, Texas, I think we're talking about 1993, under a number of things. First of all, David Koresh is running a cult. Okay, well, maybe he was, but that's not a death penalty offense. He's got firearms. Yes, well, that's totally legal in Texas. And they could be abusing the children. Well, what do you mean by abuse? Discipline, spank, I mean, what? And so the solution was, so there was, none of it was a good reason for federal agents to get involved. The local police said, we know David Koresh, these guys are harmless. And local sheriff had no problem with him. And in fact, David Koresh was in town the day before chatting to the sheriff. And there was no problems. And sheriff was horrified. And suddenly in comes the FBI and ATF into his town, where he's the elected representative for law and order, surround this place and start opening fire on him. In fact, they came in aggressively opening fire. And he said, if they'd just come to him with a subpoena, he would have delivered it to the door and David Koresh would have come into town and appeared in court on whatever they wanted. So the charges varied from they're a cult, which has nothing to do with the government, you know, First Amendment. You can believe what you like, basically. To they've got firearms. Well, what law are they breaking in having firearms in Texas? Everything's legal in Texas. To we think they might be spanking the children, which also is not illegal in Texas. But if they were concerned for the children, why did they bombard them, use electronic warfare and searchlights for how long was it, 50 odd days? These people, and so that they couldn't sleep, rock music and searchlights and all every kind of electronic warfare, so people cannot even think and sleep for 50 odd days, and then they attack them, gas them, incinerate them, kill them all. So all the children are killed to make sure they're not being abused, because they might have got spanked by their parents.
Rode an armored vehicle right through the compound, which set the...
Yes, and, when you look at Waco, Texas, they came in with armored cars and tanks and flattened the stairwells. The first points of entry that came in, they destroyed the stairwells, which were the only place of escape from the basement. And they're pumping in gas, which is highly flammable, starts fires, incinerate everybody. I mean, those people who weren't gassed got incinerated. And this is done by the federal agency against mostly women and children, because they thought they could be a cult and they might be abusing the children.
Did the people in the compound shoot back, or was it just...
Well, when they got shot at, they did shoot back, yes.
That's what they think it was about. They killed federal
But the federal agents opened fire first.
Yeah, but they killed like four or five federal agents in the first opening gun battle.
And by the way, it gets more interesting than that, because those four federal agents who died all happened to be bodyguards of Bill Clinton. And in fact, a huge amount of his bodyguards died. And if you look at the video, it looks like they were shot by their own people. That they entered through a top window.
Yeah.
And as soon as they entered, you see another agent coming and machine gunning the very room where those four people had gone in, who were part of the Secret Service and had been bodyguards of Bill Clinton. So many, many, including Gun Owners of America, Larry Pratt and others, are convinced that, in fact, those men were killed by their own side because Bill Clinton wanted them quiet because they were potential witnesses and others. So we don't even know if the ones who were shot by the Branch Davidians or whether they were shot by their own side. Whether it was friendly fire and assassination is up for discussion. But it's not a clear-cut case. Nothing's clear-cut about this. And so when the Senate wanted to investigate... How amazing that at the same time they want to investigate, up go all the files, get blown up, and, oh, sorry, we've got no records to bring to the investigation.
That stinks.
Something is really rotten. The whole thing is a mess. And it's a can of worms. The more you go into it, the more disgusting it gets.
Yeah. It's very similar thinking of Planned Parenthood. They didn't want the children to be spanked, so they gas them, but Planned Parenthood don't want the children to be abused, or, you know, they must be hungry.
Yeah, the compassions of the wicked are cruel. So, interesting. I've just been showing some of the books that of course, give other sides behind us, like The Secret War by Max Hastings, absolutely extraordinary. These are just some of... General Parton was a really innovative person thinking outside the books. And by the way, while he in the 60s, 70s, and 80s was absolutely convinced that the biggest threat to the world was communism. And winning the Cold War and defeating the Soviet Union, the evil empire, was key. By the mid-1990s, he was convinced that the biggest threat to America was not coming from external source, but from the own government. And that became a major emphasis later. And he realized as a U.S. officer, even retired, he's under military law. They could have court-martialed him. He could have not just lost his pension, he could have lost his liberty and ended up in prison. And he could have got murdered, which is pretty standard in America too, for someone who's a bit too well-known and popular. So General Parton was a brave man for making these stands. And he said publicly, I'm not giving any secrets away, he said publicly, the biggest threat to America doesn't come from Peking or Moscow, it comes from Washington, D.C. Our own government's our biggest threat. He is convinced that, and Waco, Texas, Oklahoma City bombing, of course the murder up in Idaho of John Weaver's wife and son, just other examples that all happened at this time. There's a government gone insane, and these are just a few high-profile examples, but there were literally hundreds of cases of excessive force being done by U.S. government against their own people at this time. Under Bill Clinton, it was really, really bad. I don't know how many people remember some of the outrageous things, but David Koresh and Waco, Texas, just one of the most shocking examples to see federal agents coming in tanks and armored cars against a Christian community and killing them all. And the way they came in allowed no one to get out alive. They didn't come in to take prisoners. They came in to destroy them all. They destroyed the entrances, destroyed the stairwells, destroyed everything they could. And after pumping in gas, highly flammable gas, which is banned by the Geneva Convention on warfare, they then ignited fires and killed everyone. So it was a war crime against their own people.
When did he die?
20th of December last year. But his funeral's today. In fact, it's probably taking place right now at Arlington Cemetery, the National Military Cemetery. I mean, as a Brigadier General, this is a big deal, and that's why it's such a delay, I think, about 2 months delay between his death and his official military funeral. I don't know if that's normal. Maybe they had a waiting list.
Any specific date about today?
Today's the 20th. It's exactly 2 months since he died.
But is there a historical...
I'm not aware that there's any particular historical significance why they would have chosen this date. It could have just been that that's the only time Arlington National Cemetery was open, because there'd be a full-on honor guard and everything. I mean, it's quite an operation, I'm sure, to have a funeral for a general. And someone of his stature, yes.
What was his... comments about 9/11.
I thought somebody would ask me that. General Parton, as an engineer, said, "This is not possible." He said, "The World Trade Center is incredibly strongly built to withstand jet aircraft flying into it. Steel on the outside. Most buildings have a strong reinforced concrete steel core around the lifts, and in the outside is lots of glass. Not the World Trade Center. The World Trade Center had reinforced steel all the way around the outside." Now, he then showed me a picture of a U.S. aircraft taxiing on the runway, sort of taking a wrong turn and going into a telephone pole. And a wooden telephone pole, you can see this actually on film, some people, but they shaves off the wing. The entire aluminium wing just shaves off. And the telephone pole, the wooden pole, keeps standing. Now, they then have other things that, of course, testing. He shows aircraft flying straight into concrete. It doesn't go through the concrete. Doesn't matter how fast the aircraft's going. Concrete wins. Aluminium loses. He says, if you take butter, it doesn't matter how fast you throw that butter at the knife. The knife's going to win. The butter's going to lose. You cannot take an aluminium aircraft and have it cut through reinforced steel pillars. It's not possible. A wooden pole will break the wing off the aircraft. Steel will completely break off the wing of the aircraft. You can't have aircraft flying through reinforced steel pillars and just cut them like they were butter. And so he looked at this and said, this is a controlled demolition. There had to be an explosives in that building to bring it down. You couldn't bring down a building in such perfect symmetry without controlled demolition charges built into the building. So he's one of, I think it could be thousands, but certainly hundreds of engineers who have gone on record saying the official story does not work. It's not possible. It's scientifically impossible. Doesn't matter how much fuel on the aircraft, doesn't matter how fast the aircraft's going, aluminium aircraft and jet fuel cannot collapse a reinforced steel building like that. Those have to be, in fact, showing this, the way it's going, you can actually see the explosions and hear the explosions as the thing comes out. It was a controlled implosion. Now, we know about North Tower, South Tower, but you know there's also World Trade Center 7, which also came down. There wasn't any aircraft or piece of an aircraft that hit it. And it also collapsed on its own footprint. So he was also one of those who did not believe the official 9/11 story. Correct. Yes.
Since you brought JFK up, so last year was the year where Donald Trump could release the findings of JFK's killing.
Yes.
And he didn't.
Yes, I wonder why. Do we know any, did he give any explanation?
No, no.
I would imagine, bear in mind, he does say there's, he always said there's a deep state, and it's very, very, very hard to drain the swamp and get to the deep state. Because remember, he might be the president, but there's still people, layers of bureaucracy and the FBI and the CIA and whatever that are covering their tracks. So even if he said it should be released, they might lose the material and can't explain why no one can find it or whatever. There's all kinds of things that can happen in a big... It's not like he can just personally go down to the archives and find it himself. So if they don't want to find or release it, the people concerned could have some reason why there's a glitch or the computer just deleted that whole year or whatever. I don't know, but...
If you think like 60 years after it happened, like it would have a massive effect on the American public.
I believe it would, because just take this book. Remember... Herbert Hoover, a president of the United States, America's 31st president, if I remember it right, just before Franklin Delano Roosevelt. His book was sealed for 50 years. They said if this book came out in 1960 when it was ready, it would have destroyed the Democratic Party for all of its war crimes and conniving and double dealing, lies and betraying freedom, betraying a third of the world into the hands of communism, saving the Soviet Union, all the rest. And so Herbert Hoover's book, a prisoner in the United States book, was sealed for 50 years. So, yes, I could imagine that if they think this could really destroy a lot of the narrative and the myth which the country's status and religion is built on. And also John F. Kennedy, one of America's most popular presidents, being assassinated by a lone gunman, that's one thing. But if it was a coup, and if it was, as some of these has just pointed out, that the CIA and the FBI were in on it, on the assassination of their own president, and Lyndon Johnson was part of the coup, I mean, that's different, because the Americans don't want to admit that an actual American president could have been a war criminal. Of course, Lyndon Johnson was a criminal. There's a book out, Who killed JFK? And then under it, it's got dash LBJ, Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson was, I don't think he is the mastermind, but he certainly was their man to put in his place and reverse his policies.
Was JFK a Republican or a Democrat?
No, he's a Democrat, but he was a principled man. He would make most Republicans look liberal, and he was most certainly not, he was, for example, hard on a communist on the Cuban Missile Crisis and was willing to go to nuclear war with him over that. And so he wasn't like your typical Democrat today at all. Also, he fought in the Second World War. He was a Navy PT boat commander and did some pretty brave things. And he wasn't your normal, he wasn't like a draft dodger like Clinton.
I see it's edited by George H. Nash. Is that...
He's the head of the Hoover Institute and a top scholar, historical scholar. So he got waded through this massive amount of unpublished material and produced a very good book and an outstanding summary. of it. But to think that they could seal a president's book for 50 years because they recognized it was a threat to national security.
There's so many shadows in that American history. I mean, even lately with that shooter from the top of the building, I don't know what concert he...
Yes.
Did he shoot?
Impossible amount. But the thing is, how do you get such massive military equipment into... apparently, Las Vegas casinos and hotels are some of the best secured areas around because there's a vast amount of money in those places.
Yeah.
And so there's closed-circuit TV cameras everywhere, security at every level on all sorts of things. How do you even get that up there?
And
it's not like...
It's just gone away.
You know, a pistol's one thing, but how do you get this massive firing system?
Yeah.
It was like an anti-aircraft system that he had up in this room. And not only that, but just to be able to get those armor-plated windows, which are against tornadoes and all sorts of things that can happen there. It's to have been able to remove the window, and then this guy's a ghost. I mean, we don't even know if the shooter existed.
Yeah, but it's just everything's disappeared.
You don't know anything about him either.
Yeah. It's just crazy how that can happen.
Very crazy. It doesn't make... The official version doesn't make sense.
For the version not to come up, they're still investigating. They're still investigating. There's nothing going on.
It's like South Africa's government working to get rid of state capture.
It's probably a Democrat, and they don't want to bring it out because it's going to have a Republican backlash.
Well, apparently all of these mass shooters turn out to be Democrats.
Yeah, but they're hiding that. That's all I can think.
Yeah.
Matt,
it's pretty serious.
We decided to seal the book for 50 years. Why can't they seal the Long Walk to Freedom for 50 years?
Okay, well, let's take another thing. A federal judge decided that... all of FBI files, because FBI J. Edgar Hoover wiretapped everybody, and they've got wiretaps on Martin Luther King Jr., who is Michael King, and those have been sealed 60 years, for goodness sake, 60 years, and they've got national holidays made of him. They've got to quote him endlessly like he's the patron saint of America, but you're not allowed to know what the FBI files say about him. Now, there are some FBI agents who were espionage on Martin Luther King, and they've testified. He's a communist. He's a whoremongering, fornicating, blaspheming, foul-mouthed pagan, and so the FBI people have spoken. So we can guess what's on these tapes. Apparently, the night before he was assassinated by this person who shot him, he had a whole lot of prostitutes in the hotel room and having a whoremongering orgy, and they turn him into a saint. But they conceal it, and Senator Helms even requested that they unseal the files just for the lawmakers to decide whether they want to declare a national holiday in his name, and they wouldn't even let the lawmakers have a look at these files. Totally sealed.
Where did they store the files? Amongst a lot of rats or what?
Who knows? Who knows? But it's... When governments seal files, you know they're lying. Because if those files justified them, they would have them published on the front page. But when governments seal things like Operation Keel Hall, the betrayal of the Russians and Ukrainians in Western Europe to KGB, sealed for 30 years. Lusitania files sealed for 60 years. The sinking of the Lusitania. When they came out, found it actually it was a false flag operation in order to get America involved in the war and so on. And on one after the other, you can take like this series of books on the secret war. Yes, Max Hastings. He's able to get hold of, after 60 years, the GCHQ, Enigma code and all of that. All those files were released. And now, as I've said, every single war book, documentary, and film of Second World War needs to be rewritten, because it completely turns on its head so much of what we know about Second World War, because these are the secret files that were just forbidden for any historian to look at. So you had to go with the propaganda. You weren't allowed to give what the intelligence agencies knew was the facts at the time. Yeah. So, any other comments? Questions? Yes, we have. Okay, just a couple of examples. One of the classic false flags is the head of the Southern Communist Party, Joe Slovo's wife, Ruth First, was assassinated by parcel bomb in Maputo, which they always conveniently blamed on the apartheid government, police, army, whatever, it doesn't matter. I mean, somebody on the South African side sent a parcel bomb to Ruth First, the wife of Joe Slovo, and she died in Maputo from it. So she's a martyr to the revolution. But it turned out that, in fact, while the South African government would have gladly taken the credit because she was a nasty piece of work, but it turned out to be a false flag. The ANC did to themselves, and with Joe Slovo's approval, because she was, in fact, a Trotskyite, and she was ideologically at variance with the rest of the movement. And so they decided to get rid of her, but like many communist things, blame it on the enemy. You know, like a Tan Forest massacre or something like this. You know, just say the enemy did. So that's one false flag, that the ANC made a big thing that they assassinate, that the South Africans that assassinate Ruth First, whereas actually they assassinated themselves, is another one. Actually, before I get there, Mozambique's classic is that their patron saint, the founder of the Frelimo terrorist movement, Eduardo Mondlane, he was murdered by the Portuguese somehow. Turns out he was actually murdered by his underling, Samora Machel, and they've named the main street Eduardo Mondlane Boulevard and all of that sort of thing. But Michelle got rid of him so that he could get the top. Similarly, the leader of ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe, Josiah Tongarora, he was the war hero. He was the leader of the ZANLA, Zimbabwe Army, National Liberation Army. He gets murdered by Mugabe so that Mugabe can take credit. Now, of course, Josiah Tongarora is a hero of the revolution, but he was actually assassinated by his own side. And the big one in this country is Chris Hani. Chris Hani was assassinated apparently by this Polish chap with Conservative Party, the English-speaking Conservative Party chap was blamed and thrown to prison for it. But in fact, according to Winnie Mandela and the General of Transkei, he started the UDM. Sorry? Bonte Holomisa. General Bonte Holomisa and Winnie Mandela maintain to this day, well, Winnie Mandela has, of course, gone to eternal reward, but Bonte Holomisa still maintains to this day that it was an inside job. The ANC assassinated Chris Hani with the connivance and knowledge of both Zuma and Thabo Mbeki, because they had no chance at being president if Chris Hani is alive. Chris Hani is young, comparatively at that stage. He was charismatic. He was a good speaker, a very eloquent speaker, far more eloquent than Mandela. And he would have definitely been Mandela's number two. And after Mandela's first term, he would have been the president of South Africa. And so that assassination, which was blamed on white South Africans, was actually organized by the ANC to get rid of this leader. So,
what was their motivation? Why did they want to get rid of him?
Because he was blocking the way to Thabo Mbeki and Zuma becoming president. He would have, because they couldn't, they weren't eloquent public speakers like Chris Hani. Chris Hani is a really, I mean, I've heard and I've debated Chris Hani in public. Chris Hani he was the most dynamic leader of the ANC and South African Communist Party. Streets ahead of Mandela and the rest. And he had such a charismatic presence, he could have definitely dominated. He would have been the next president. In fact, Mandela would have been the first one just because he had been built up to that status for that. But Chris Hani would have been doing the work, and then he would have been the president in 99 when Mbeki was a nothing. I mean, as boring as hell, didn't inspire anyone.
Drunk.
Well, yeah, that's the nicest thing you can say, man. But so there is, according to people within the ANC, like Bantu Olomisa and Winnie Mandela, a false flag done by their own side. So those are just some false flags right there. Can you think of other false flags offhand?
No, I thought of Chris Hani as well. Is that so? Yeah. Yes.
What about Samora Machel himself flying into the South Africa, putting up the beacon, a false beacon?
Well, according to the US astronaut and British high tech, and they had an international team that came in. They looked at it and they said, this was human pilot error. This is controlled descent into ground. This was entirely, this wasn't technical error. There was no mistake. The aircraft wasn't at fault. The equipment wasn't at fault. It was the pilots were drunk and distracted and ignoring the instructions of the ground warning and ignoring everything. So the British, American, other foreign, I think there was a group of three that I just remember those two on the panel. They came, but they're all not South Africans. They came to the conclusion there was no outside interference. This was just human pilot error, control descent into ground. Nothing wrong with the aircraft, the Tupolev, the equipment. Just human error that caused their death. And so there was no conspiracy, because nobody could have actually connived to bring this plane down like that. It was entirely just pilot error.
But they still said that part of the government did it.
Well, it's convenient, but there's no evidence. And if they could have proven that, and when apartheid government collapsed, people were out there spilling beans, blowing whistles all over the place, they would have had, if they could have got someone who testified before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission or something, I mean, the guy could have really got himself all kinds of settlements. They would have paid him off, but they never prosecuted anyone. They couldn't point to anyone. If there was a conspiracy to have brought it down, which would have been pretty brilliant because we were at war with them, it would have come out by now. I've got to assume that the initial external investigation was correct. There was no conspiracy. It wasn't an assassination. It was just human error.